Buck poked his turnip again and put it back into the fire. Aye, well, I mean it. I'm no a very good person. It was such a waste, I mean, if I didn't make it.
His lips twisted a little as he glanced up at Roger.
You've maybe got a bit more to offer the world. I'm flattered, Roger said dryly. I imagine the world can get on well enough without me if it came to that. Aye, maybe. But maybe your family can't.
There was a long silence while Roger digested that, broken only by the pop of a burning twig and the distant hooting of courting owls.
What about your own family? He asked at last, quietly. You seem to think your wife would be happier without you. Why? What did you do to her?
Buck made a short, unhappy noise that might have been meant for a wry laugh.
Fell in love with her.
He took a deep breath, looking down into the fire.
Wanted her.
He'd met Morag Gunn just after he'd begun reading law with a solicitor in Inverness. The lawyer had been called to go out to a farm near Essex to draw up a will for an old man, and had taken his junior along to see the way of it.
It took 3 days, for the old man was that ill. He couldn't attend more than a few minutes at a time. So we stayed with the family, and I'd go out to help with the pigs and the chickens when I wasn't needed inside.
He shrugged.
I was young and no bad-looking, and I had the trick of making women like me. And she did like me. But she was in love with Donald McAllister, a young farmer from Daviot.
But Buck had been unable to forget the lass, and whenever he had a day free from the law, he would ride out to visit. He came for Hogmanay, and there was a Cayley, and...
And wee Donald had a dram, or maybe two or three or four, too many, and was found in a stall wi' his hand down Mary Finlay's bodice. God, the stramash there was!
A rueful smile flickered over Buck's face.
Mary's twa brothers gave Donald Laldy, and laid him out like a mackerel, and all the lasses were screaming, and the lads shouting like it was Judgment Day. And poor wee Morag was off behind the cow byre, greeting her heart out. You comforted her,
Roger suggested, not trying to keep the sceptical note out of his voice. Buck shot him a sharp glance, then shrugged.
Thought it might be my only chance, he said simply. Aye, I did. She was the worse for drink herself, and that upset. I didn't force her.
His lips pressed together.
But I didn't take no for an answer either. But after a bit, she gave up seeing it. Aye. And when she woke up next morning and realised...
Buck cocked her brow.
She didn't say anything to anyone then. It was 2 months later when she realised...
Buck had arrived at Mr. Ferguson's rooms one day in March to find Morag Gunn's father and three brothers waiting for him, and as soon as the banns could be read, he was a married man.
So,
Buck took a breath and rubbed a hand over his face.
We got on. I was mad in love with her, and she kept that, and tried to be kind to me. But I knew well enough it was Donald she wanted, and still did. He was still there, Ken, and she'd see him now and then at the Caelan or the cattle sales.
It was knowing that had made Buck take the opportunity to sail for North Carolina with his wife and small child.
Thought she'd forget, he said a little bleakly. Or at least I wouldn't have to see the look in her eyes when she saw him.
But things had gone badly for the Mackenzies in the New World. Buck had failed to establish a practice as a solicitor, and they had little money and no land, and they had no one in the way of kinfolk to turn to for help.
So we came back, Buck said.
He rolled the turnip out of the fire and stabbed it with his stick. The black crust broke and oozed white. He stared at the vegetable for a moment, then stamped on it, mashing it into the ashes.
And Donald was still there, of course. Was he married?
Buck shook his head, then knuckled the hair out of his eyes.
It was no good, he said softly. It was true, what I told you about how I came to pass through the stones.
But once I'd come to myself and discovered how things were, I kent Morag would be best served if I never came back. Either she'd give me up for dead after a time and marry Donald, or at the worst, her father would have her back with the bairns. They'd live well. Her da had inherited the farm when his old one died. Roger's throat felt tight, but it didn't matter. He reached out and squeezed Buck's shoulder hard. Buck gave a small snort, but didn't pull away. After a bit, though, he heaved a sigh and straightened up, turning to Roger.
"So you see," he said, "if I go back and tell your wife what's to do, and with luck, come back to tell you, it's maybe the one good thing I could do for my family. For yours."
It took some time for Roger to get his voice sufficiently under control as to speak.
"Aye," he said. "Well, sleep on it. I mean to go up to Lallybroch. You'll maybe go and see Dougal Mackenzie at Leoch. If you think you still mean it after, there's time enough to decide then."
Chapter 106. A Brother of the Lodge. Craignadun, the Scottish Highlands, December 21st, 1980. Esmeralda's hair was much too red. Somebody will notice. They'll ask questions. "You idiot, why are you even thinking about it? They'd notice a Barbie in a polka dot bikini a heck of a lot faster." Brianna shut her eyes for an instant to blot out the sight of Mandy's rag dolly with her scarlet fright wig, brilliant, with a dye much brighter than anything achievable in the 18th century. She tripped on a stone, said S-word under her breath, and her eyes, having flown open, took a firmer hold of Mandy's free hand, the other being employed to clutch Esmeralda. She knew bloody well why she was worrying about the doll's hair. If she didn't think of something inconsequential, she was going to turn right around and run down the rocky slope like a panicked hare, dragging Jem and Mandy through the dead gorse.
"We're going to do it. We have to.
We'll die. We'll all die in there, in the black... Oh, God. Oh, God."
"Mum?"
Jemmy looked up at her, small brow furrowed. She made a good attempt, she thought, at a reassuring smile, but it must have looked less than convincing, judging from his alarmed expression.
"It's okay," she said,
abandoning the smile and putting what little conviction she could muster into her voice.
"It's okay, Jem."
"Ah." He still looked worried, but he turned his face uphill and his expression smoothed out, intentness replacing concern.
"I can hear them," he said softly. "Can you hear them, Mama?"
That Mama made her hand tighten, and he winced, though she didn't think he really noticed.
He was listening.
She came to a stop, and they all listened. She could hear the rush of the wind and a slight patter as brief rain swept through the brown heather. Mandy was humming to Esmeralda, but Jem's face was turned upward, serious but not frightened. She could just see the pointed top of one of the stones, barely visible above the crest of the hill.
"I can't, honey," she said, letting out just a bit of the huge breath she'd been holding.
"Not yet."
"What if I can't hear them at all? What if I've lost it? Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us. Let's get a little closer."
She'd been frozen inside for the last 24 hours. She hadn't been able to eat or sleep, but had kept going, shoving everything aside, tamping it down, refusing to actually believe that we're going to do it, yet making the necessary preparations in a state of eerie calmness. The leather bag hanging from her shoulder clanked a little, reassuring in its solid reality. Weight might be heavy to carry, but it would hold her steady against the pull of the wind and water, secure against the earth. Jem had let go of her hand, and she reached compulsively through the slit in her skirt, to feel the three hard little lumps in the pocket tied round her waist. She'd been afraid to try synthetic stones, for fear they wouldn't work, or might explode violently, like the big opal Jemmy had burst into pieces in North Carolina. Suddenly she was swept by a longing for Fraser's Ridge and her parents, so intense that tears welled in her eyes. She blinked hard and wiped her eyes on her sleeve, pretending that the wind had made them water. It didn't matter. Neither of the kids was noticing. Now both of them were staring upward, and she finally realized, with a small, flat thump of dread, that she could hear the stones. They were humming, and Mandy was humming with them. She glanced behind her involuntarily, checking to be sure that they hadn't been followed. But they had. Lionel Mingus was coming up the path behind them, climbing fast.
"F-word," she said aloud,
and Jem whirled to see what was going on.
"Mr. Mingus,"
he said, and his face broke into a smile of relief.
"Mr. Mingus!"
Bree gestured firmly to Jem to stay where he was and took a couple of steps down the steep path toward Mingus, little rocks sliding under her shoes and bouncing downhill toward him.
"Don't be afraid," he said, coming up breathlessly and stopping just below her. I had to come. Be sure you were safe. That you get away."
He nodded upward, looking beyond her. She didn't turn to look. She could feel the stones now, humming gently, for the moment, in her bones. "We're okay," she said, her voice surprisingly steady. "Really, thank you," she added, belatedly polite. His face was pale and a little strained, but quirked into a small smile at that.
"My pleasure," he said, with equal politeness.
But he didn't move to turn and go away. She breathed for a moment, realizing that the frozen core had thawed. She was alive again, completely and thoroughly on the alert.
"Is there some reason why we might not be safe?" she asked, watching his eyes behind the glasses.
He grimaced slightly and glanced over his shoulder.
"Shit," she said. "Who? Rob Cameron?"
She spoke sharply and heard the creak of gravel under Jem's shoes as he turned sharply, hearing the name.
"Him and his friends, yes."
He nodded uphill.
"You really should go. Now, I mean."
Brianna said something really bad in Gaelic, and Jemmy gave a nervous giggle. She glared at Mingus.
"And just what were you planning to do if Rob and his band of jerks all turned up after us?"
"What I just did do," he said simply. "Warn you. I'd bloody go if I were you. Yet I'm daughter."
She whirled round to see Mandy, Esmeralda, in the crook of one arm, stumping laboriously up the path. "Jem!" She took one giant step, seized him by the hand, and they bolted up the hill after Mandy, leaving Lionel Mingus on the path below. They caught Mandy up, right at the edge of the circle, and Bree tried to grab Mandy's hand but missed. She could hear Lionel Mingus coming up behind them. "Mandy!" She grabbed the little girl and stood, panting, surrounded by stones. The hum was higher pitched and making her teeth itch. She gnashed them once or twice, trying to rid herself of the feeling, and saw Mingus blink.
"Good."
Then she heard the sound of a car's engine below, and saw Mingus's face change to a look of acute alarm.
"Go," he said. "Please."
She fumbled under her skirt, hands shaking, and finally got hold of all three stones. They were the same kind, small emeralds, though of a slightly different cut. She'd chosen them because they reminded her of Roger's eyes. Thought of him steadied her. "Jem," she said, and put a stone in his hand. "And Mandy, here's yours. Put them in your pockets and..." But Mandy, little fist clutching her emerald, had turned toward the biggest of the standing stones. Her mouth drooped open for a moment. Then suddenly her face brightened as though someone had lit a candle inside her.
"Daddy!"
she shrieked, and yanking her hand out of Brianna's, raced directly toward the cleft stone and into it.
"Jesus!"
Brianna barely heard Mingus's shocked exclamation. She ran toward the stone, tripped over Esmeralda, and fell full length in the grass, knocking out her wind.
"Mama!"
Jem paused for a moment beside her, glancing wildly back and forth between her and the stone where his little sister had just vanished.
"I'm okay," she managed,
And with that assurance, Jem charged across the clearing, calling back,
"I'll get her, ma'am."
She gulped air and tried to shriek after him, but made only a wheezing croak. The sound of feet made her glance fearfully round, but it was only Lionel, who'd run to the edge of the circle, peering down the hillside. In the distance, she could hear car doors slamming. Doors? More than one. She staggered to her feet. She'd fallen on the bag and bruised her ribs, but that didn't matter. She limped toward the cleft stone, pausing only to scoop up Esmeralda by reflex. God, 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 was the only thought in her head, an agony of unworded prayer. And suddenly the prayer was answered. Both of them stood in front of her, swaying and white-faced. Mandy threw up. Jem sat down hard on his bottom and slumped there, wavering.
Oh, God.
She ran to them, grabbed them hard against her in spite of the nastiness. Jem clung to her a moment, but then pushed himself away.
"Ma'am," he said, and his voice was breathless with joy. "Ma'am, he's there. We could feel him. We can find him. We gotta go, ma'am."
"You do."
It was Lionel, back, breathless and scared, tugging at Brianna's cloak, trying to straighten it for her.
"They're coming. Three of them."
"Yes, I..."
But then realization struck her, and she turned to the children in panic. "Jem? Mandy? Your stones? Where are they?"
"Burned up," Mandy said solemnly, and spat into the grass. "Patootie! Yuck!"
She wiped her mouth. "What do you mean?"
"There they are, ma'am. See?"
Jem turned out the pocket of his breeches, showing her the burnt spot, and the smear of carbon black around it, smelling strongly of scorched wool. Frantic, she fumbled at Mandy's clothes, finding the same scorch mark on the side of her skirt, where the vaporized stone had burned through from her pocket.
"Did it burn you, honey?"
she asked, running a hand down Mandy's sturdy little thigh.
"Not much,"
Mandy reassured her.
"Brianna, for God's sake, I can't..."
"I can't,"
she shouted, rounding on him, fists clenched.
"The kids' stones are gone.
They can't... they can't go through without them." She didn't know for sure that this was true, but the thought of letting them try to go into that, without the protection of a stone shriveled her stomach, and she nearly wept with fright and exasperation.
"Stones?" he repeated, looking blank. "Jewels, do you mean? Gemstones?"
"Yes!"
He stood for an instant with his mouth open, then fell to his knees, yanking at his left hand, and the next instant was whacking his right hand feverishly against a rock that lay half-sunk in the grass. Bree stared at him helplessly for a moment, then ran to the edge of the circle, ducked round a stone, and stood flat against it in the shadow, looking out. By peering sideways, she could just see human forms halfway up the hill and moving fast. On the other side of the stone, Mingus gave a grunt of pain or frustration, and smacked something hard against the rock with a small cracking noise.
"Brianna," he called urgent,
and she rushed back, afraid the children were trying to go through. But it was all right. They were standing in front of Lionel Mingus, who was stooping over Mandy, holding one of her hands.
"Curl up your fist, wee lassie,"
he said, almost gently.
"Aye, that's it. And Jem, here, put out your hand."
Brianna was close enough now to see that it was a small glittering thing he put in Jem's palm, and that Mandy's fist was curled around a large ring, rather battered, with a Masonic emblem carved into its onyx, and the twin of Jem's small diamond winking beside it, an empty socket on the other side.
"Lionel," she said,
and he reached out and touched her cheek.
"Go now," he said. "I can't leave until you go. Once you're gone, though, I'll run for it."
She nodded jerkily once, then stooped and took the children's hands.
"Jem, put that in your other pocket, okay?"
She gulped air and turned toward the big cleft stone. The racket of it hammered at her blood, and she could feel it pulling, trying to take her apart.
"Mandy," she said, and could barely hear her own voice. "Let's find Daddy."
"Don't
Don't let go.
It was only as the screaming began that she realized she'd not said, thank you. And then she thought no more. Chapter 107. The Burying Ground. She loved Lallybroch in winter. The gorse and broom and heather didn't seem to die so much as simply to fade back into the landscape, the purple heather fading to a soft brown shadow of itself, and the broom to a cluster of dry sticks, their long flat pods rattling softly in the wind. Today the air was cold and still, and the soft grey smoke from the chimneys rose straight up to touch the lowering sky.
Home, we're home, Mandy said, hopping up and down. Goody, goody, goody. Can I have a cook?
It isn't home, Goofy, Jem said.
Only the pink tip of his nose and a flicker of eyelash was visible in the gap between his woolly hat and the muffler around his neck. His breath wisped white.
It's then. They don't have cooks now.
Besides, he added logically, it's too cold to drink cook. Your tummy would freeze.
Huh?
Never mind, honey, Brianna said, and tightened her grasp on Mandy's hand. They were standing at the crest of the hill behind the house, near the remains of the Iron Age fort. It had been a laborious haul up the hill, but she'd been reluctant to approach the house from the front, where they would have been visible for a good quarter mile, coming across open ground.
"Can you feel Daddy anywhere nearby?" she'd asked the children.
She'd automatically looked for Roger's old orange Morris in the drive as they'd crested the hill, and felt a ridiculous plunge of spirits at seeing neither car nor gravelled drive.
Jem shook his head.
Mandy didn't answer, distracted by a faint bleating from below.
"The sheep," she said, delighted. "Let's go see the sheep."
"It's not sheep," Jem said rather crossly. "It's goats. They're in the broch. Can we go down now, Mum? My nose is about to fall off."
She was so hesitant, watching the house. Every muscle was straining, pulling toward it.
Home.
But it wasn't her home, not now.
Roger.
The strong, sweet, supple quality he has. Of course, she knew that he likely wasn't here. He and Buck would be searching somewhere for Jerry Mackenzie. And what if they found him, she thought, with a little thump of something between excitement and fear. The fear was what was stopping her racing down the hill to hammer on the door and meet whatever of her family happened to be home today. She had spent the last few days on the road. And the hours on the final walk from where the carter had dropped them, trying to decide. And her mind was still as divided as ever.
Come on, she said to the kids.
She couldn't keep them standing out here in the cold while she made up her mind.
Let's visit the goats first.
A smell of goats struck her the moment she opened the door. Pungent, warm, and familiar. Warm, above all. All three humans sighed in relief and pleasure as the animal heat rolled over them, and they smiled at the eager rush and outcry of meh's that greeted their presence. From the noise that echoed off the stone walls, there might have been 50 goats inside the broch, though Brianna counted only half a dozen nannies, flop-eared and dainty, four or five half-grown, round-bellied kids, and a single robust billy goat who lowered his horns and glowered at them, suspicious and yellow-eyed. All of them shared a rough pen that fenced off half the ground floor of the broch. She glanced up, but instead of the exposed rafters high above that she half expected to see, there was the intact underside of another floor above. The kids, her kids, that is, and she smiled at the thought, were already sticking wisps of hay through the fence and playing with the young goats, who were standing on their back legs to peer at the visitors.
Jemmy, Mandy, she called, take off your hats and mufflers and mittens and put them over by the door, so the goats don't chew on them.
She left Jem to disentangle Mandy from her fuzzy muffler and went up the stairs to see what was on the second floor. Pale winter light from the windows striped the haunches of burlap bags that filled most of the floor space. She breathed in and coughed a little. Flower dust was floating in the air, but she smelled the sweetness of dried corn, maize they called it, and the deeper, nutty smell of ripe barley as well. And when she nudged her foot against a particularly lumpy sag, she heard the shift and clack of hazelnuts. Lallybroch wouldn't starve this winter. Curious, she went up one more flight, and on the top floor found a good number of small wooden casks arrayed against the wall. It was much colder up here, but the heady aroma of good whiskey filled the air with the illusion of warmth. She stood, breathing it in for a moment, wanting very badly to be drunk on the fumes, to obliviate her mind, be able not to bloody think, if only for a few minutes. But that was the last thing she could do. In minutes, she'd have to act. She stepped back onto the narrow stair that wound up between the inner and outer walls of the broch and looked out toward the house, with vivid memories of the last time she'd been here, crouched on the stairs in the dark with a shotgun in her hands, watching the light of strangers in her house. There were strangers here now, too, although her own blood. What if... She swallowed. If Roger had found Jerry Mackenzie, his father would be only in his early 20s, much younger than Roger himself. And if her own Da was here now... He can't be, she whispered to herself, and wasn't sure if that was reassurance or regret. She'd met him for the first time in North Carolina, pissing against a tree. He'd been in his 40s, she 22. You couldn't enter your own lifeline, couldn't exist in the same time twice. They thought they knew that for sure. But what if you entered someone else's life twice, at different times? That was what was turning her blood to ice and making her curled fists tremble. What happened? Did one or the other of your appearances change things, perhaps cancel out the other? Would it not happen that way? Would she not meet Jamie Fraser in North Carolina if she met him now? But she had to find Roger, no matter what else happened. And Lallybroch was the only place she knew for sure he'd been. She took a deep, deep breath and closed her eyes. Please, she prayed, please help me. Thy will be done, but please show me what to do. Ma'am! Jemmy came running up the stair, his footsteps loud in the confined stone corridor. Ma'am! He popped into sight, blue eyes round and hair standing half on end with excitement. Ma'am, come down. A man's coming. What does he look like? She asked urgent, grabbing him by the sleeve. What colour is his hair? He blinked, surprised. Black, I think. He's at the bottom of the hill. I couldn't see his face. Roger. All right, I'm coming. She felt half choked, but no longer frozen. It was happening now, whatever it was, and energy fizzed through her veins. Even as she hurtled down the stairs behind Jemmy, rationality told her that it wasn't Roger. Distance or not, Jemmy would know his father, but she had to see. Stay here, she said to the children, with so much command in her voice that they blinked but didn't argue. She threw open the door, saw the man coming up the path, and stepped out to meet him, closing the door firmly behind her. From the first glance, she saw that it wasn't Roger. But the disappointment was subsumed at once in relief that it wasn't Jamie. And intense curiosity, because it must surely be. She'd run down the path to get well away from the broch, just in case, and was picking her way through the stones of the family burying ground, eyes on the man coming up the steep, rocky path. A tall, solid-looking man, his dark hair greying a little, but still thick, glossy, and loose on his shoulders. His eyes were on the rough ground, watching his footing. And then he came to his destination and made his way across the hill to one of the stones in the burying ground. He knelt by it and laid down something he'd been carrying in his hand. She shifted her weight, uncertain whether to call out or wait till he'd finished his business with the dead. But the small stones under her feet shifted too, rolling with a click, clack, click that made him look up. And seeing her, rise abruptly to his feet, black brows raised. Black hair, black brows.
Brian Dhu.
Black Brian.
I met Brian Fraser. You would like him, and he you.
Wide, startled hazel eyes met hers, and for a second that was all she saw. His beautiful, deep-set eyes, and the expression of stunned horror in them. Brian, she said, I...
A year.
He went whiter than the hard plaster of the house below.
Ellen.
Astonishment deprived her of speech for an instant, long enough to hear light footsteps scrambling down the hill behind her.
Mam?
Jem called, breathless. Brian's glance turned up behind her, and his mouth fell open at sight of Jem. Then a look of radiant joy suffused his face.
Willie,
he said.
Avalach, Movalach.
He looked back at Brianna and stretched out a trembling hand to her.
Mugri, Mugria.
Brian, she said softly, her heart in her voice, filled with pity and love, unable to do anything but respond to the need of the soul that showed so clearly in his lovely eyes. And with her speaking of his name for the second time, he stopped dead, swaying for a moment. Then the eyes rolled up in his head, and he fell. She was kneeling in the crunchy dead heather beside Brian Fraser before she'd even thought to move. There was a slight blue tinge to his lips, but he was breathing, and she drew a deep, cold breath of relief herself, seeing his chest rise slowly under the worn linen shirt. Not for the first time she wished fervently that her mother was there, but turned his head to one side and laid two fingers on the pulse she could see at the side of his neck. Her fingers were cold, and his flesh was startlingly warm. He didn't rouse or stir at her touch, though, and she began to fear that he hadn't just fainted. He'd died, would die, of a stroke. If there was some weakness in his brain, oh God, had she just killed him prematurely?
Don't die,
she said to him aloud. For God's sake, don't die here. She glanced hastily toward the house below, but no one was coming. Looking down again, she saw what it was he'd held. A small bouquet of evergreen twigs tied with red thread. Yew, she recognized the oddly tubular red berries. And holly. And then she saw the stone. She knew it well. Had sat on the ground beside it often, contemplating Lallybroch and those who lay sleeping on its hillside. Ellen, Katrina, Shaelis Mackenzie Fraser, beloved wife and mother, born 1691, died in childbed, 1729. And below, in smaller letters, Robert Brian Gordon Mackenzie Fraser, infant son, died at birth, 1729. And William Simon Murtagh Mackenzie Fraser, beloved son, born 1716, died of the smallpox, 1727.
Ma'am?
Jem skidded down the last few feet, almost falling beside her.
Ma'am, ma'am, Mandy says... Who is he?
He stared from Brian's pallid face to her own, and back again. His name's Brian Fraser. He's your great-grandfather. Her hands were trembling, but to her surprise, she felt suddenly calm at the speaking of the words, as though she'd stepped into the centre of a puzzle and found herself to be the missing piece. What about Mandy?
Did I scare him?
Jem squatted down, looking worried.
He looked at me just before he fell down. Is he dead?
Don't worry. I think he's just had a shock. He thought we were somebody else. She touched Brian's cheekbone, feeling the soft prickle of his beard stubble, and smoothed the tumbled hair behind his ear. His mouth twitched a little as she did so, the ghost of a half-smile, and her heart jumped. Thank God he was coming round. What did Mandy say?
Oh, J
Jem stood up, fast, eyes wide.
She says she hears Dad.
Chapter 108.
Reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away.
Roger turned his horse's head toward Lallybroch, knowing nowhere else to go. He'd taken leave of Brian Fraser 6 weeks before, and had been sad at what he'd thought was a permanent parting. His heart was eased a little now at the thought of seeing Brian again, also at the certainty of a sympathetic ear, even though there was little he could openly discuss with him. He'd have to tell Brian, of course, that he hadn't found Jem. That thought was a thorn in his heart, and one felt at every beat. For the last weeks, he had been able to put the brutal ache of Jemmy's absence aside for a little, hoping that somehow finding Jerry might also lead to finding Jem. But it hadn't. What the devil it did mean was a complete mystery. Had he found the only Jeremiah there was to be found here? If he had, where was Jem? He wanted to tell Brian that he'd found the man to whom the identity discs belonged. Brian would ask. But how to do so without divulging either Jerry's identity, Roger's relationship with him, or explaining what had happened to him? He sighed, reining his horse around a large puddle in the road. Maybe better to say simply that he'd failed, hadn't found J.W. Mackenzie, though it troubled him to lie outright to such an open-hearted man. And he couldn't discuss Buck, either. Beyond thought of Jem, Buck was the matter lying heaviest on his mind at the moment.
You'll never make a decent minister if you can't be honest.
He tried to be. The honest truths of the situation from his own selfish point of view were that he'd miss Buck's company badly, that he was deeply jealous of the possibility that Buck might make it to Brianna, and, not least, he assured himself, that he was terrified that Buck wouldn't make it through the stones again. He'd die in the void, or maybe be lost once more, alone in some random time. The truth for Buck was that while it could be argued, and with no little force, that Buck should remove himself forthwith and permanently from the vicinity of Gilles Duncan, going through the stones was maybe the least desirable means of ensuring such an outcome. To accept Buck's gallant gesture was a temptation, though. If he could make it, tell Bree where Roger was. Roger didn't think Buck could come back, though. The effects of travel were cumulative, and Hector McEwen likely wouldn't be standing by next time. But if Buck was willing to risk the crossing, in spite of the very real danger to his own life, surely it was Roger's obligation to try to persuade him to return to his own wife, rather than to Roger's. He brushed the back of his hand against his lips, feeling in memory the softness of Morag's brown hair on his cheek when he'd bent to kiss her forehead on the banks of the Alamance. The gentle trust in her eyes, and the fact that she'd bloody saved his own life very shortly thereafter. His fingers rested for an instant on his throat, and he realized, with the flicker of surprise that attends recognition of things already long known, that whatever the bitterness of his regrets about his voice, he'd never for an instant wished that she hadn't saved him. When Stephen Bonnet would have thrown Morag's son overboard, Roger had saved the child from drowning, and that at some risk to his own life. But he didn't think she'd done what she'd done at Alamance in payment of that debt. She'd done it because she didn't want him to die.
Well, he didn't want Buck to die.
Did Morag want Buck back? Buck thought not, but he might be wrong. Roger was fairly sure that the man still loved Morag, and that his abnegation was due as much to Buck's own sense of personal failure as to what he thought Morag's desires might be.
Even if that's true, he said aloud, where do I get off trying to manage people's lives?
He shook his head and rode on through a light mist that wove shreds of fog through the wet, black spikiness of the gorse. It wasn't raining, that was one thing, though the sky bore a burden of cloud that brought it down to shroud the tops of the nearby mountains. He'd never asked his adoptive father anything about the art of being a priest. It was the last thing he'd ever thought of being. But he'd grown up in the reverend's house and had seen parishioners come every day to the comfortably shabby study in search of help or advice. He remembered his father, and now felt a new oddness in the word, layered as it was with the freshness of Jerry Mackenzie's physical presence. Remembered him sitting down with a sigh to drink tea in the kitchen with Mrs. Graham, shaking his head in response to her questioning look and saying,
"Sometimes there's nothing you can give some of them but a friendly ear and a prayer to be going on with."
He came to a dead stop in the road, closed his eyes, and tried to find a moment's peace in the chaos of his thoughts. And ended, as every priest since Aaron's time doubtless had, by throwing up his hands and demanding,
"What do you want of me? What the hell should I do about these people?"
He opened his eyes when he said that, but instead of finding an angel with an illuminated scroll standing before him, he was confronted by the beady yellow eyes of a fat seagull sitting in the road a few feet from his horse, and not discomposed in the slightest by the presence of a creature 100 times its size. The bird gave him an old-fashioned sort of look, then spread its wings and flapped off with a piercing squeak. This echoed from the hillside above, where a few more gulls wheeled slowly, barely visible against the paper-white sky. The presence of the gull broke his sense of isolation, at least. He rode on in a calmer frame of mind, resolved only not to think about things until he had to. He thought he was close to Lallybroch. With luck, would reach it well before dark. His belly rumbled at the prospect of tea, and he felt happier. Whatever he could and couldn't tell Brian Fraser, just seeing Brian and his daughter Jenny again would be a comfort. The gulls cried high overhead, still wheeling, and he looked up. Sure enough, he could just make out the low ruins of the Iron Age hill fort up there. The ruins he'd rebuilt. Would rebuild? What if he never got back to...
"Jesus, don't even think about it, man. It'll drive you crazier than you are already."
He nudged the horse, and it reluctantly accelerated a bit. It accelerated a lot faster in the next moment when a crashing noise came from the hillside just above.
"Whoa! Whoa, you idiot! Whoa, I said!"
These adjurations, along with a heave of the reins to bring the horse's head around, had an effect, and they ended facing back the way they'd come, to see a young boy standing, panting, in the middle of the road, his red hair all on end, nearly brown in the muted light.
"Daddy,"
he said, and his face lit as though touched by a sudden sun.
"Daddy."
Roger hadn't any memory of leaving his horse or running down the road, or of anything else. He was sitting in the mud and the mist, in a patch of wet bracken with his son hugged tight to his chest, and nothing else mattered in the world.
"Dad,"
Jem kept saying, gasping with sobs.
"Daddy, Daddy."
"I'm here,"
he whispered into Jem's hair, the tears running down his own face.
"I'm here, I'm here. Don't be afraid."
Jem took a shuddering breath, managed to say,
"I'm not afraid,"
and cried some more. At last, a sense of time crept back, along with a sensation of water soaking through the seat of his breeches. He breathed and shuddered a bit himself, smoothed Jem's hair, and kissed his head.
"You smell like a goat,"
he said, swallowed, and brushed at his eyes with the back of a hand and laughed.
"Where the hell have you been?"
"In the brook with Mandy,"
Jem said, as though this was the most natural statement in the world. He gave Roger a faintly accusing look.
"Where have you been?"
"Mandy,"
Roger said blankly.
"What do you mean, Mandy?"
"My sister,"
Jem said, with the patience children occasionally show for the denseness of their parents.
"You know."
Well, where is Mandy, then?
In Roger's state of surreal confusion, Mandy might just as well have popped up beside Jem like a mushroom. Jem's face went momentarily blank with confusion, and he glanced round as though expecting Mandy to materialise out of the moss and heather at any moment.
"I don't know,"
he said, sounding mildly puzzled.
"She ran away to find you, and then Mam fell down and broke something and..."
Roger had let go of Jem, but grabbed him again at this, startling the breath out of the boy.
"Your mother's here too?"
"Well, sure,"
Jem said, sounding mildly annoyed.
"I mean, not here. She's up there, in the old fort. She tripped on a rock when we were running to catch Mandy."
"Jesus Lord,"
Roger said fervently, taking a stride in the direction of the fort, then halting abruptly.
"Wait. You said she broke something. She's hurt?"
Jem shrugged. He was beginning to look worried again, but not very worried. Dad was here. Everything would be okay.
"I don't think it's bad," he assured his father. "She couldn't walk, though, so she told me to run and catch Mandy. But I found you first."
"Okay, she's awake, though. She's talking."
He had Jem by the shoulders, as much to keep him from disappearing. He half feared he was hallucinating, as to compel an answer.
"Uh-huh."
Jem was looking vaguely about, a slight frown on his face.
"Mandy's here, someplace."
Wriggling free, he turned round slowly, face creased in intent concentration.
"Mandy!"
Roger shouted up the hill. He cupped his hands around his mouth and yelled again.
"Bree!"
He scanned the fort and the hillside anxiously for Bree's head popping up above the ruins or any sign of agitation among the vegetation that might be occasioned by a scrambling three-year-old. No head showed, but a breeze had come up, and the whole hill seemed alive.
"Mandy ran away down this hill?"
he asked, and at Jem's nod, he glanced behind him. The land flattened out into moor on the other side of the road, and there wasn't a glimpse of anything that might be Mandy on it. Unless she'd fallen down and was lying in a hollow.
"You stay right here," he said to Jem, squeezing his shoulder hard. "I'm going to go up the hill and look. I'll bring your mother down."
He bounded up the gravel trace that was the nearest thing there was to a path, calling out Mandy's name at intervals, torn between overwhelming joy and terrifying panic, lest it not be real, lest he actually had cracked and was simply imagining that Jem was there. He turned at every third step to check that he was there, still standing on the road.
"Bree."
The thought that she was up there, just above him.
"Mandy!"
he shouted again, his voice cracking. But it cracked from emotion, and he realized in a startled instant that he'd been shouting at full volume for minutes now, and it hadn't hurt.
"God bless you, Hector,"
he said fervently under his breath, and went on, beginning now to zigzag back and forth across the hill, beating through the sticks of dry broom and birch saplings, kicking at gorse and dead ferns in case Mandy should have fallen, maybe knocked herself out on a rock. He heard the seagulls shriek above, thin and piercing, and looked up, hoping to see Brianna peering over the wall of the fort. She wasn't. But something called again, thin and piercing, but not a gull.
"Daddy!"
He whirled, almost losing his footing, and saw Jem running down the road and coming round the bend of that road, Buck's horse with Buck atop him, and a wildly squirming bundle with black curly hair cradled precariously in Buck's arm. He couldn't speak at all by the time he reached them.
"Think you might have lost something,"
Buck said gruffly, and handed Mandy carefully down to him. She was a heavy, lively weight in his arms, and smelled of goats.
"Daddy!"
she exclaimed, beaming at him as though he'd just come in from work. "Mwah! Mwah!" She kissed him noisily and snuggled into his chest, her hair tickling his chin.
"Where were you?"
Jem was saying accusingly.
"Where was you?"
Mandy countered and stuck her tongue out at him.
"Bleh!"
Roger was crying again, couldn't stop. Mandy had burrs and foxtails stuck in her hair and the fabric of her jacket, and he thought she might have wet herself somewhere in the recent past. Buck twitched the reins as though about to turn and go, and Roger reached out a hand and grabbed his stirrup.
"Stay," he croaked. "Tell me it's real."
Buck made an incoherent noise, and looking up through his tears, Roger could see that Buck was making an inadequate attempt at hiding his own emotion.
"Aye,"
Buck said, sounding almost as choked as Roger. He looped his reins, and, sliding off into the road, took Jem very gently into his own arms.
"Aye, it's real."
Chapter 109 Frottage. Dr. McEwen was a single man and owned a single bed. The bed was presently accommodating four people, and even if two of those people were not full-sized, the general atmosphere was that of the London Tube in rush hour. Heat, random flesh in all directions, and a distinct shortage of oxygen. Brianna squirmed, trying to find room to breathe. She was lying on her side, back pressed to the wall, with Mandy squashed into a heavily breathing mass between her parents. Roger balanced precariously on the bed's outer edge, with Jem draped bonelessly over him, Jem's legs occasionally twitching spasmodically, prodding Bree in the shins. And Esmeralda was taking up most of the single pillow, red yarn hair getting up everyone's nose.
"Do you know the word frottage?"
Bree whispered to Roger. He wasn't asleep. If he had been, he'd have been on the floor by now.
"I do. Why, do you want to try it now?"
He reached carefully across Jem and stroked her bare arm lightly. The fine hairs rose on her forearm. She could see them do it, lifting silently in the dull glow from the hearth.
"I want to do less of it with a three-year-old."
Mandy zonked. "Is Jem asleep enough to move?"
"We'll find out. I'm going to suffocate if he's not."
Roger edged out from under his son, who emitted a loud, but then smacked his lips and subsided. Roger patted him softly, bent to check that he was solidly asleep, and straightened up.
"Okay, then."
They'd appeared at McEwen's door well after dark. Brianna supported, between Roger and Buck, the children at their heels. The doctor, while clearly surprised at this nocturnal invasion of Mackenzie's, had taken it calmly, sitting Bree down in his surgery with her foot in a pan of cold water, and then going to call his landlady to find a bit of supper for the children.
"A sprain, and not too bad,"
he'd assured Brianna, drying her foot with a linen towel and expertly palpating her swollen ankle. He passed a thumb up the problematic tendon and noted her wince.
"It will just take time to heal, but I think I can ease the pain a bit, if you like."
He glanced toward Roger, brow raised. And Brianna breathed in through her nose. "It's not his ankle," she said, mildly annoyed, "and I'd certainly appreciate anything you can do." Roger nodded, to her further annoyance, and McEwen took her foot onto his knee. Seeing her grip the edges of the stool to keep her balance, Roger knelt behind her and wrapped his arms around her.
"Lean on me,"
he said quietly in her ear.
"Just breathe. See what happens."
She shot him a puzzled look, but he merely brushed her ear with his lips and nodded toward McEwen. The doctor's head was bent over the foot, which he held lightly in both hands, his thumbs on her instep. He moved them slowly in circles, then pressed firmly. A sharp pain shot up her ankle, but died abruptly before she could gasp. The doctor's hands were noticeably warm on her chilled flesh, and she wondered at that, since they'd been immersed in the same cold water as her foot. One hand now cupped her heel, and thumb and forefinger massaged the puffy flesh lightly, repeatedly, then a little harder. The sensation hovered unsettlingly somewhere between pain and pleasure. McEwen looked up suddenly and smiled at her.
"It will take a little time," he murmured. "Relax. if you can.
In fact, she could. For the first time in 24 hours, she wasn't hungry. For the first time in days, she was beginning to thaw out completely. And for the first time in months, she wasn't afraid. She let out her breath and eased her head back on Roger's shoulder. He made a low humming noise in his throat and took a firmer hold, settling himself. She could hear Mandy telling Jem a disjointed story about Esmeralda's adventures in the back room where the landlady had taken them to eat their soup and bread. Sure that they were safe, she gave herself up to the elemental bliss of her husband's arms and the smell of his skin.
But the expression of a well-made man appears not only in his face. It is in his limbs and joints also. It is, curiously, in the joints of his hips and wrists. "Bree," Roger whispered to her some moments later. "Bree, look."
She opened her eyes and saw at first the curve of his wrist where it rested on her bosom, the hard elegance of bone, and the curve of muscled forearm. But then her focus widened, and she started a little. Her toes were glowing with a faint blue light barely visible in the crevices between them. She blinked hard and looked again to be sure she was really seeing it. But the sound Roger made in his throat assured her that she was, and that he saw it too. Dr. McEwen had felt her startlement. He looked up and smiled again, this time joyful. His eyes flicked up toward Roger, then back to her.
"You too," he said. "I thought so."
He held her foot still for a long moment until she thought she felt the pulse in his fingers echo in the spaces between the small bones. And then he wrapped a bandage neatly around her ankle and lowered her foot gently to the floor.
"Better now?"
"Yes," she said, and found her voice a little husky.
"Thank you."
She'd wanted to ask him questions, but he rose and put on his coat.
"You'll oblige me greatly by staying here the night," he said firmly, still smiling at her. "I'll find a bed with a friend."
And raising his hat to Roger, he bowed and went out, leaving them to put the children to bed. Not surprisingly, Mandy had put up a fuss at sleeping in a strange bed in a strange room, complaining that Esmeralda thought the surgery smelt funny and was scared of the big wardrobe because there might be kelpies in it.
"Kelpies only live in water, silly," Jem had said,
but he also looked a little apprehensively at the enormous dark armoire with its cracked door. So they'd all lain down on the narrow bed together, parents comforted as much as children by sheer physical proximity. Brianna felt the soft warmth and the haze of exhalation blanketing her bodily exhaustion, a pull on her senses beckoning her toward the well of sleep, but not nearly such a strong pull as her sense of Roger.
It is in his walk, the carriage of his neck, the flex of his waist and knees. Dress does not hide him.
She lay for a moment, hand on Mandy's back, feeling the slow beating of the child's heart, watching as Roger scooped Jem into his arms and turned to lay him down on one of the extra quilts McEwen's landlady had brought up with the soup. The strong, sweet, supple quality he has strikes through the cotton and flannel. He was dressed in nothing but shirt and breeks, and now paused to shed the homespun breeks, casually scratching his arse in relief, the long linen shirt momentarily rucked up to show the lean curve of a buttock. Then he came to pick up Mandy, smiling over her stertorously breathing body at Bree.
"Leave the bed to the kids, you think? We could make up a pallet with the cloaks, if they've dried out a bit, and quilts and the surgery."
He gathered Mandy up like an armful of laundry, and Bree was able to sit up and scoot across the bed, feeling a wonderful movement of air through her perspiration-dampened shift, and a brush of soft fabric across her breasts that made her nipples rise. She turned back the bedding,
He moved the children back to the bed, and she covered them and kissed their dreaming faces, kissing Esmeralda for good measure before tucking her into Mandy's arm. Roger turned toward the closed door to the surgery and looked back at Bree over his shoulder, smiling. She could see the shadow of his body through the linen shirt against the glow of the hearth. To see him pass conveys as much as the best poem, perhaps more. You linger to see his back and the back of his neck and shoulder side.
"Wilt bed with me, lass,"
he said softly, and put out a hand to her. "Oh, yes," she said, and came to him. The surgery was cold after the humid heat of the bedroom, and they came to each other at once, warm limbs and warm lips seeking. The fire in this room had gone out, and they didn't trouble to rebuild it. Roger had kissed her the moment he saw her on the ground in the fort, grabbing her and lifting her into an embrace that crushed her ribs and nearly bruised her lips. She'd had no objection whatever, but now his mouth was soft and tender, and the scruff of his beard light on her skin.
"Fast," he murmured against her mouth. "Slow." "Horizontal," she murmured back, clutching his bottom. "Speed, irrelevant."
She was standing on one leg, the bad foot elegantly, she hoped, extended behind her. Dr. McEwen's ministrations had eased the throbbing quite a bit, but she still couldn't put weight on it for more than the briefest second. He laughed, quietly, with a guilty look toward the bedroom door, and bending suddenly, scooped her up and staggered across the room to the coat rack, where she snagged the hanging cloaks and tossed them onto the floor by the table, that being the cleanest open space visible. He squatted, back creaking audibly, and manfully suppressing a groan as he lowered her gently onto the heap.
"Be careful," she whispered, and not jokingly. "You could put your back out, and then what?" "Then you'd get to be on top," he whispered back, and ran a hand up her thigh, her shift rippling up with it. "But I haven't, so you don't."
Then he pulled up his shirt, spread her legs, and came to her with an incoherent noise of deep satisfaction.
"I hope you meant it about the speed being irrelevant," he said in her ear a few minutes later.
"Oh, yes," she said vaguely, and wrapped her arms round his body. "You just stay put." When she could, she let him go, cradling his head and kissing the smooth, warm flesh at the side of his neck. She felt the rope scar and gently drew the tip of her tongue along it, making goose flesh erupt all over his back and shoulders.
"Are you asleep?"
he inquired some moments later, suspicious. She opened one eye halfway. He'd gone back into the bedroom for quilts, and was kneeling beside her, spreading one over her. It smelled faintly musty, with a tang of mice, but she didn't care.
"No,"
she said, and rolled onto her back, feeling wonderful, despite the hard floor, her sprained ankle, and the dawning realization that Dr. McEwen must do operations and amputations on the table. There was a dark stain on the underside, above her head.
"Just limp."
She stretched out a slow hand to Roger, urging him under the quilt with her.
"You?" "I'm not asleep,"
he assured her, sliding down close beside her.
"And if you think I'm going to say limp, think again."
She laughed, quietly, with a glance at the door.